welcome to As the Worm Turns. You are tuned in to KVNF's live call-in gardening show. I'm Jill Spears, your host, and happy to be here after our spring drive show last week. Super fun.
Yeah, we had a good time. Many comments. Mainly we were having quite a rowdy time.
We did. Thanks to our guests, Molly from Zephro's, the Garden Guy and the Garden Pimp. And super fun. And thanks to everyone who pledged and supported not only just our show, but KVNF in general. We so appreciate you. And we are a live call-in show. So I'm going to give you the phone numbers because we've got a special guest tonight. 970-527-4868-866. KVNF Now. You can email any of your questions to worm@kvnf.org. Lance Swaggart joining me tonight as usual.
Oh, yeah.
How are you doing, Lance?
I'm doing okay, working through the weather.
Right. It was chilly out there.
Yeah, it was chilly and blown away yesterday.
Yeah, that wind has been crazy. And our special guest tonight, Brad Tonneson, PhD. Hi, Dr. Brad.
Hey, how's it going, Jill? Hey, worms. Yeah, great to be here again.
Yeah. Good. Love you're checking in with us for early season, and the scientist is in the house.
Watch out.
Yeah, give us a call. Brad is part of the umbrella, which is CSU Agricultural Experiment Station. That's the big picture. Western Colorado Research Center up on Rogers Mesa. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure everybody drives by it, and now you're probably sitting in traffic right in front of it.
Right.
Yeah, but a great, great, great resource that we have here in the Valley. And Brad, do you want to tell us about the Research Center and a little bit of its history and what you do?
Yeah, sure. Could talk about the history, about the place, because maybe you haven't been there yet. So we are a research center, part of 10 different research centers across the state from CSU. And ours is a little special because we are 100% organic, and that's unique. Across the whole country, there's not a research center dedicated to that. So how about that?
That's great. That's awesome.
But we have some interesting tidbits from the past. You know, when I say we, I mean, I wasn't alive yet, but it was the early 1900s when the place started. And it was to teach World War I veterans how to tend an orchard, be orchardists.
Really? That long ago?
Uh-huh. Wow.
I wasn't aware of that. Wow. That's super cool.
Yeah, it was in Austin. Okay. Just down the road from us, where we are now.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Neat. Mm-hmm.
But our place, you see on the highway at 92, that started in the 60s is when they built that one. Mm-hmm. But yes, a little bit about us now. So we are organic, like I said, and we do research in tree fruit, so peaches, apples mostly. My expertise is in pests and disease and plant breeding, so we try to find solutions to those kind of problems in trees, but we also have wine grape trials, a new table grape trial going in, as well as vegetable work. So mixed vegetables for the mid-scale farmer, helping to serve our stakeholders in this area.
Yeah. What about the cider apples?
We do have cider apples too. Yeah, I forgot.
Okay. I saw it on your list there. So.
Yeah, we have a new rootstock trial, right? So all tree fruit professionally put on rootstock. It helps keep the tree from getting huge and out of control. Essentially, rootstock started 100 years ago or so just to keep those trees small and tendable, prunable. Mm. And we just keep it going. And so we try different new rootstocks that have come out on this same above ground piece, the Scion, which is a cider apple called Porter's Perfection.
Okay.
So, it's a fun one. We also have a lot of heirloom apples from the Montezuma Orchard Restoration Project. And that's all we're tending. It's starting to make fruit now. So once we can get some data on how these are doing, we might be advertising Scion wood for everyone, but
Scion wood—that's the type of apple.
No, that's the wood that they use to graft onto the rootstock.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. People can get their own heirloom apples, Colorado orange, say, and other things.
Oh, mm-hmm. Wow. That's exciting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Seems like you're really organized up there, that there's really been this comeback dedicated to science over the last, 5 years maybe?
Mm-hmm.
That it really has exploded your trials and that type of thing. Is that my...
Well,
making that up.
Thanks. Yeah. we've just been really trying to reach out to the community, be a presence, give out information, let everyone know what we're doing. And really, when I started, it was 3 years ago, I was just trying to, what are some nice projects for each type of grower in the area? And so that's what we'd have a fungal disease in peach and the coddling moth in apples and regional seed for vegetables, things like that.
Right.
Yeah, so we're continuing that on. And really, we want to focus a lot more on helping the community and learning what the growers want. We have an advisory committee of the larger players in ag in our area who can speak to the different types of agriculture that goes on in the valley. And we have a nice focus group get together, tackle some issues. We hear from them. They hear from us. And it really helps us understand how we can be more service-oriented to the community.
Yeah, and
neat.
The community seems to be showing up for events and all of the different projects, learn about all the different projects you have going on.
Yeah. I mean, if you haven't seen it, I'm getting back into Instagram, so I've been posting there. Watch out. We have it's at CSU Rogers Mesa, if we want to try to find it. I'm trying to keep an updated list of all the workshops we have, and that's been sent out to our emails, and you'll try to, find it online somewhere. But we're having more and more workshops every year on things from dry land seeding to squash bugs, to peach pruning.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So you just had your apple care and pruning workshop up there in the day of the wind blowing.
Yeah.
And, apples are a big part of this valley. And can we talk a little bit about the netting thing that's going on?
Because
been going on at the station, and also just all over the valley.
Yeah.
You see so many nets now. Can you tell us what that's all about?
I sure can. So if you don't know, those nets are for the coddling moth. So it's the proverbial worm in your apple. If you have a backyard tree and you're not really doing much to it, you're probably seeing a rotted core and a hole in every single one of them. Your tree is harboring the coddling moth, giving it a nice little habitat. It lives on here. It's all over the world. I mean, it's a problem everywhere. But here, it's been a huge issue, especially for organic growers, because there's not a lot of sprays and methods that really keep it at bay well enough. And this netting technology, pretty simple, right? Just put a net on the tree, and the bugs don't get in. But this came from hail netting in Australia, and it was adapted to this area, just try to keep the coddling moth out, and it's been super successful for growers. I mean, it's a silver bullet for them.
Mm-hmm.
They have like 100% good apples coming out of those netted trees rather than 90% bad. And
do they have to still spray at all?
Well, we don't at all for coddling moth. Mm-hmm. We still do for other stuff.
Okay,
and that spray can go through the net.
Okay.
There's a large enough aperture size in the net that sprays can get through, because, we still have fire blight issues and things like that. We've had some interesting results this past year because we're still looking at how are these nets doing. We keep monitoring it. We're even looking at insect populations under the nets. And this year will be the second year we're doing that. So we'll have some good results for the growers about what is that micro ecosystem effect of netting these trees all season? What bugs can get in there? Is it beneficials? Is it just bad ones? But the interesting thing that came out of this past year was we realized that a lot of people were interested in putting these nets on maybe during bloom, right? So in the spring, the flowers bloom, and apple thinning is a really big issue because when all those flowers get fertilized and they're developing fruit, that's a lot of fruit to thin. And you have to thin because each cluster is like seven flowers. If you let them all go, then you just have a bunch of tiny, green, gross apples. So you have to thin them down, and that's a lot of work. So if we put these nets on during bloom, maybe keep some pollinators out. And so keep the flowers from getting pollinated. Thus, less fruit gets developed. Maybe apple thinning is less of a big job. And so we tried an experiment for 2 years now. So we just did the second year last year. So we got some good results. And we were putting the nets on at different times of flowering. So we'd have to go out there and count each open flower, divide it by all the flowers on the tree, which we also counted, and did that daily. Be like, all right. We're at 50%, so we're going to put a net on these trees, and then 75% and 100%, and we started at zero. So we did, like, before the flowers open, we put some nets on. And what we found is that you could get this, like, comparable crop load of apples if you netted at 75% bloom. And when I say crop load, I mean it's, like, fruit per trunk area.
Okay.
All right. So it's it's like a normalized way of saying how much fruit does the tree have based on how big it is.
Sure.
And you could get a comparable thinning of apples to what you would have normally done, like put the nets on after bloom, all the flowers fell off. That's when you put the nets on. And then you'd hand thin everything. But if you put those nets on at 75% bloom, you were getting the same kind of crop load.
Okay.
But there's a problem there because the fruit didn't have as many seeds in them when you put the nets on early, right? So we actually took 100 fruit from each of these treatments and cut them open and looked at the starch content. So that's like a maturity thing, but also number of seeds. And there's a lot less seeds in the fruit when you've put the nets on early. And that makes sense because you're keeping the pollinators out, so there's less seeds developed from pollination. But the problem with having less seeds is that the fruit tend to develop slower. Like, they don't get as mature.
Interesting.
And so you're putting these nets on early, you're thinning your apples, which is good, but the weird variable pollination of all these different fruit could give you all these different maturity levels of fruit. Either it's very ripe or it's not so ripe. And so if you did that, then you go through with your big crew, you're getting like this mix of apples. So we're starting to think that maybe it's not so much of a good idea.
Put it on later.
Yep. And face the facts and hand thin all of them.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So what, you got to climb under the net to thin those out then?
Oh, yeah, you do. But you can prop up that net while you're doing it, and you have a little shade, so that's nice.
There's the benefit right there. All right, so learning a lot about apples. But I think the result of having from 10% to 100% is pretty stellar results. That's right. And all kinds of varieties of apples going on up there, and that's pretty exciting. And so you say that the coddling moth is a problem all over the country or everywhere. A lot of apples up in Washington. Are they doing the same thing up there?
You know, I would assume the organic growers are, but there's a lot of conventional apples up there. And you got plenty of sprays to deal with it.
Okay. So, yeah, this is all
organic.
They got
a Washington State apple board.
You
know, that does nothing but apples.
And they get access to all the new varieties first, too, because that's where they breed them. And then all the growers in that state get their hands on them first. And we We get them a few years later when patent protection runs out.
Gotcha. Sounds like a lot of work. How many staff members do you have up there making this all happen? Netting them, mm-hmm. thinning them, cutting the apples open, testing the starch. I mean.
Yeah, and that's just a tiny part of what we do.
Right. I mean, that's just one project.
So it's me. I'm the scientist, but then we have two year-round full-time research associates, and and they're the ones that are getting a lot of the stuff done out in the field, the more technical things, managing the place. We also have a new manager for the Western Colorado Research Center. His name's Brian Reed, and he just started a couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm.
But he's managing three different centers all at once. So it's us, but then it's the one in Grand Junction and the one in Fruita.
Right.
Just outside of Grand Junction.
We're going to try to nab him to be on the show. So.
Yeah, good. Yeah, okay. That's great.
Yeah, good deal. And how are you funded? Are you funded through CSU? Or how does that work? USDA?
Right. Yeah, we are funded in different ways. All the projects we do, like the specific research projects, are grant funded. And that's often through federal or state funds and a whole proposal program for that. But in terms of us, like the research center, the three people I was talking about who work there, including myself, we're all funded through the Hatch Act. And that's, if you haven't heard of it, when did that start? I think it was late 1800s. And and that was, it was an offshoot of, you know, the land grant mission that created all of the state colleges. And that started with Abraham Lincoln. And then the Hatch Act came through a little later, which funded all of these ag experiment stations around the country. And so that's been continuing through farm bill after farm bill until today. Wow. And we're, you know, we hope it keeps going.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's how we're funded. You know, we have a little base level of a budget that keeps it going. And then grants are the icing on the cake for all of the extra things we do.
So you have, I'm going to give the phone numbers, 527-4868-866, KVNF now. You have a new project coming up for squash bugs. Is that a grant that you sought out?
So that's through the Colorado Department of Agriculture. So they give out a specialty crops grant program. And we define specialty crops as anything that's not a larger commodity crop or a field crop or a forage, right? So specialty crops, you could say veggies, fruit, things like that. And so the funding came from that. And yeah, it's been a big push from growers in our area. They want a solution to squash bug. And I think we all would like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that writing that grant and going for that grant came out of like your advisory committee and focus groups and community feedback? Is that?
Yes.
Cool.
Wow.
Advisory committee, and then it was groups of growers that came out for, you know, different events we have. So Nicole Didero is also at our station. She's part of CSU Extension. And she works in food systems mostly. And she's been really great at getting the community together too. She's been holding a brown bag lunch to try to invite producers over, just talk shop, talk about whatever. Twice a month.
Wow.
And through those meetings that she was putting together, that squash bug project materialized too. And so it's been really nice inviting the community out, and then we try to answer their needs.
Now you're just gonna plant big patch of squash and see what happens?
Yes.
And just different varieties and everything. Yeah.
It's gonna be a little of seeing what happens. But actually we're not going to do different varieties, which is, I mean, I'll explain why, is because we're going to focus on methods of, like, how to grow, methods of control, and we're picking a kabocha squash.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and just so people know, that's the family of Maximus.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. so they know that's a Maxima.
Yeah, Maxima, kind of a small one.
Mm-hmm. Those are really good.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. Apparently for the growers that grow a little more acreage, it's a more profitable squash
yes.
for them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're picking it.
Okay. Uh-huh. So directly mm-hmm. related again to yeah. what people mm-hmm. in the valley need. Mm-hmm. And how's that going to work? Tell us about how they lay work? That experiment out.
Yeah.
You thought about that yet,
long time
Dr.
coming.
Brad?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about it for a while, and then the funding got a little iffy there, but it's back.
Oh, good.
So we're good.
Yay. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we're going to try a lot of different things. And first thing, which is pretty basic, which we just have to try, is different sprays. Mm-hmm. And they're all organic, but they're also different types. So first off, we do have to have a control, as always, because we're doing this study, which means it's going to be a patch of untouched squash that's mm-hmm. going to get destroyed.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And but we're also going to try spraying with, it's a product called Azagard, and it's based from neem oil.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the active ingredient in neem oil.
So it's concentrated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And then, so that will be a spray we try. That's a funky one. It inhibits the growth of insects. So we're kind of hoping the development from nymph to adult gets
messed up.
Yeah. And, okay. But, you know, that's stuff we got to try because the growers at larger scale are always kind of looking at, well, what spray can I do? Because I don't like putting nets on all of my squash because then they talk about all the plastic they buy and all the
mm-hmm. – mm-hmm.
But we are going to try nets too, but I'll get into that. So other sprays we're trying too are just plant-based oils. So peppermint oil, rosemary oil, geraniol, which is a – product from geraniums and other plants, and all of those are somewhat insecticidal but also repellent
mm-hmm.
in a way. Yeah. And I don't know, Lance, have you tried something like that?
Essential oil of thyme and sage.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have tried it.
I've heard of thyme. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done that. And then the other one that you haven't got there yet, but different planting times.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lulu's adamant. Plant those squash in mid-June or later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? They'll come up faster. The soil's warm.
Right. Yeah.
So
it's a win-win.
Yeah.
Yeah. We actually, we will be planting about mid-June.
Just to, okay.
And yeah, I think it's a good concept, right? You're putting your squash in the ground after that first generation of adults
yes.
came out of the ground and found your neighbor.
Or yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
so you won't get squash until they get curious and they,
yeah.
you know, that new generation tries to find new squash.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you a good leg up. So what we're going to do is we're not going to try different planting dates because we're on one site. So if we do different planting dates, they're pretty much just going to go from one thing to the next. So instead, we're trying just your basic row cover, like frost protection.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put it on the plants right after you transplant them in the ground and then take them off once they start flowering. So that's mm-hmm. a basic practice.
Yeah.
It's been proven too. So that's why we're doing it, just to see how good it works compared to other things. But, essentially, yeah, you're mimicking that late planting date because you're just not yeah. making them accessible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Wow.
I think a lot of people are really into the essential oils out in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be real popular with organic gardeners, mm-hmm. just backyard yeah. gardeners.
Yeah, you might try, clove oil.
Oh, yeah.
It's a deterrent uh-huh. also.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Actually, we have one more slot in the treatment set.
That, okay.
And it's left for a final idea. So maybe
okay.
Glove oil might be it.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's even more things we're testing. I'm not done yet. Mm-hmm. So in terms of nets, one thing we thought would be really cool to try, because what you'd love is maybe to keep these squash protected for the whole season. And we have a bunch of leftover apple nets around. Mm-hmm. And the size of the openings in those nets is probably small enough to keep a squash bug out. But from the studies we were doing of what insects get underneath the nets in the apple trees, there's plenty of pollinators that make it in.
Okay.
Not large bees and things, but small ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so we might get enough pollination underneath there, kind of like we had a little bit of pollination in the apple trees that were netted early. We might be able to just keep those apple nets all season on the squash plants.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and you might be able to keep out the other pests, the squash vine borer.
Right.
With that netting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with those. we'll have to get some larger hoops for that since they're going to grow well into that.
But, yeah.
So we're going to try some nets. We're going to try some of these sprays, some oils. And the last thing we're going to do is some different soil treatments. So y'all heard of roller crimping?
No, tell us about that.
I haven't heard of it.
It's semi of new method. A lot of it was developed by the Rodale Institute. And what it is you grow a grass cover crop. Usually it's a fall seeded. And then you let it grow in the spring. And once it gets really tall and it starts to flower and then set seed. So really the technical time to do this is when it starts hitting that milking stage.
The grain that's there, the milk stage.
Yeah. So if you squeezed the grain, it would just be a liquid, a milky liquid.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, everything's growing up and it's getting more rigid. And so then what you do is you essentially steamroll it. Not steamroll it, but we use a roller crimper.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is, it's a big cylinder, the front of your tractor, and it's probably about 2 feet wide in diameter, and you fill it up with water so it gets real heavy. And it has all these ridges on it too. So you roll it on this cover crop and it breaks it and then flattens it on the ground. And so, and that kills the grass or whatever you have. For us, it's going to be a rye or triticale or something like that, and it becomes a mulch, and then you also preserve all of the roots and the soil structure.
Yeah,
yeah. And so we're going to try that because there's some data out there that it might encourage beneficial insect populations, generalist predators that might like to eat squash bug eggs, things like that. Like ground beetles like to. And so we're thinking, well, maybe this is going to help those populations. And then we'll see if that might stave off the squash bug a little longer than other treatments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to just mention Rodale Press, which we haven't mentioned at all, but they were the Organic Gardening magazine. It originally was Organic Gardening and Farming. And then they split off and became Organic Gardening Magazine and Organic Farming Magazine. So they have a lot. They probably got 75 years of information there.
Wow. Yeah. Great resource.
And it's in Pennsylvania, isn't it? Eminence, Pennsylvania is where they're located at.
Right.
Wow. Sounds like a lot of work getting started for just this year. How long does the whole trial go on?
Oh, all season. Yeah. And we're... We haven't planted them in the greenhouse yet, so we'll transplant them all, but it's going to be about 3,000 squash plants.
Okay.
Which is a couple acres.
Yeah.
That could be a big patch. You could get lost in that.
Well, you could have a invite the public to come and plant.
Yeah, that would be great.
That would be get people more involved.
Yeah.
That would be fun. Or weed, at least.
Yeah.
Now you're thinking.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and hear from a couple underwriters, and we'll be right back with Dr. Brad Tonneson from the Western Colorado Research Center on Rogers Mesa. Mm-hmm. And we are back. You're listening to As the Worm Turns on your community radio station, KVNF. I'm Jill Spears here with our guru gardener, Lance Swaggart, and Dr. Brad Tonneson from the Western Colorado Research Center up on Rogers Mesa, talking about science, science matters.
Yeah.
Love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we just talked about the squash bug trial going on, and it looks like you've got a peach care and pruning workshop coming up on April 3rd. And you've had some peach tree experiments going on for quite some time now, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. And, yep, this workshop is put on by Brian Braddy, who's our resident orchardist, works there at the station. And, yeah, he does a great job. He's a great natural teacher. And we get out there for an hour and do a pruning demonstration, too, out in our peaches. So, yeah. Come on out if you want to learn all you can on that. But in terms of experiments, we're still ongoing with trying to find solutions to Cytospora canker disease, which is a fungal pathogen, if you haven't heard of it. The spores are everywhere. They're on the bark. They're in the soil. They're in the water. They're in the air. So there's not much you can do. But, you know, a healthy tree can stave it off, but where we are here in the wintertime, right, we got sunny days and all the leaves are off the tree. So that bark is warmed up by the sun, and then at night it freezes, and then the next day it thaws, at night it freezes. And what happens there is you get these little micro breaks in the bark because of that. And then your spore notices that there's a little moisture there for it to grow, and then that's where you get your cankers. And so as long as there's a little moisture and some broken bark, you got problems. And so if you see some blackness in your peach tree or some oozing sap out of an area, there it is. And what happens is the tree could keep living, especially if that is on a big branch coming off the side of your tree, then just cut it off and you're fine, because it doesn't travel very fast. But if it is at the base of your trunk, then your tree is probably going to be done in 3 years or so.
Okay.
Yeah. That's my peach tree. Yeah.
We'll cut it down soon.
Yeah, absolutely. So what have you found that is helpful for that?
So we've been trying a lot of different things. You know, I was trying to induce the tree's immune system, you know, get them stronger, almost like vaccinating the tree in a way where you introduce some organic compounds that trigger the immune response of the tree. And then it's going to create a lot of these, you'll call them like secondary metabolites, but really those things that are good for you, like the vitamins you take, things like that. And they're in there that help the tree respond and kill whatever comes in faster. And we've tried some things like silica is actually one of those. And seaweed extract. And those were the two that seemed the most promising from the past experiments. So it's ongoing with looking at that. We'll do a spray of that stuff on the tree. And then we then wound the tree and inoculate with a spore suspension of this disease. So we get that ready in the lab, and then we'll just pipette droplets of the disease on a wound and then come back 6 weeks later and see how bad it is. But really what's becoming more promising now is biological treatments. So you've heard of these for the soil. Inoculants, things like that. And I'm sure Jerlo could talk about that more than I can. but a lot of these organisms that you put in the soil are also helpful against diseases like, soil-borne diseases for sure. But looking at diseases that hit the bark is actually relatively new for seeing how biologicals can do anything against them. And this one fungus So it's another fungus that fights this bad fungus, and it's called Trichoderma. And there's a lot of different products out there, like Root Shield is one of them. So it's all based for like soil applications, but what we're doing is just spraying it on the tree and seeing what happens. And it's seeming to hold off infection and make it less severe. So there's something to do with the Trichoderma living on the bark and competing with Cytospora and even maybe killing it even. So we're trying like products that are out there, but we also have an isolated Trichoderma from peach orchards in our valley. So we actually have that, and we're trying to spray that as well.
Because it's already here.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's naturalized and ready to go. So that's probably the most interesting one. We're going to delve into that more this year.
So people with a single tree, it's part of my mind. You're saying that what if they whitewash the south side of the tree for the winter?
It's probably a great idea.
Because you won't get the
freeze thaw
because breakage. It's white, you know, and it's reflecting the sun, you know. Right. So if it stays frozen, you know, this is just a thought when you're talking about that.
No, I would say, yeah, for people with their own single trees or manageable to paint them all, do it because that can definitely help that cold damage, the freeze thaw damage. Yeah. That's going on. But for these orchardists that have hundreds and hundreds of trees, and you know what's even worse is that when we're organic, we're not allowed to use latex paint. Like, we can't put latex paint on our trees. So then you have to find some other way of painting the tree, and usually it's a type of paint that just gets washed off pretty easily.
Right. You know? Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So for us backyard gardeners and backyard tree lovers, whitewash it.
Yeah, I would. And you can mix that latex paint 50-50 with the water.
Yeah, water it down.
Water it down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Yeah. Doesn't have to be full strength.
So can us normal people drop in at the research station and get information about these trials? And let's say we have a bad peach tree and we want to get some answers. Are you guys there to do that, or mostly through your workshops and events?
Oh, well, you know, that's when we're most publicly facing, but no, people are free to drop in any time of day, business hours, please. But yeah, you know, we might be out there in the field. We might be busy doing something. So if you're patient, you might be able to find us. Yeah. And we can do our best to figure out your issue. There's plenty of people who come by with plants in a bag and they're asking what's wrong with it. And we do our best to figure something out, or at least point them in the right direction, right? Because we have our resources at CSU Extension, which are really built for that. You know, the master gardeners do a lot of plant diagnostics and things like that out in Mesa County. And we're hoping to build that capacity more here. But for now, we got a whole network at CSU that can help.
And you've got a lot going on.
What about your, you mentioned table grapes?
I did mention table grapes.
We talked about that last year, didn't we?
It's still coming along. We're planting a new variety trial this spring, and that's with Charlotte Oliver, who is our state.
I have her card.
Viticulturist. You should talk to her.
Yeah, give her a call.
She could talk your ear off with grapes. I know a lot less than her. We're planting a new table grape trial, and from what I know, it is it's different types. So, you know, you got your green ones, and you got your blue ones, and you got your red ones, and I think purple's another one.
Yeah.
And so we're having a couple varieties from each of those types. And then what we're also doing is starting a few table grape varieties from the Minnesota breeding program. So some of the latest stuff coming out of them that are cold tolerant, really good. Because our last planting of table grapes all died to the ground because of that freeze in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of revitalizing that. What we're also doing is there's some growers that have vineyards of table grapes already. And so we're going out there and we take data on how quickly they develop, when the buds come out,
yeah,
when they're ready to harvest, different stages of growth. So we can figure out maybe from what we already see, what's the best variety out there. Yeah. But Lance, do you have any table grapes?
I have table grapes. Yeah,
I thought so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And stuff. So, yeah, and they're doing pretty good. But that, what did you say, that hard fall freeze in 2020, mm-hmm. I cut them all to the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what happened.
So this is another one, is for the longest time, they did not think you needed to have grafted grapes here. But that disease has showed up. Was that?
Phylloxera?
Yeah, showed up in, I think, down in the Grand Valley. And it's how you get fight it is you have grafted rootstock. You have your, which, and it's the wild North American grape that you graft onto. So I don't know if that has to, if you're doing anything with that.
So, yeah, that's a good question. So from what I know, what I think I know, is that table grapes have more of those American genetics in them already.
Okay.
So I think they're better suited against phylloxera already.
All right.
So none of our table grapes we're planting are grafted. It's all just own-rooted stuff.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But yes, that's an issue. And so all the wine grapes we have, like we planted a new trial of wine grapes, which is and they're all these hybrids with Merlot. So they're not necessarily like a known variety, but they're all going to be cold tolerant and they're all grafted on the rootstock that can handle that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And if I recall, up at Field Day, you have taste tests going on. And last time I was there, you had a lot of different grapes that people could try. And who was the winner? What's been popular? Yeah.
The variety that was best was Vanessa.
Oh,
okay.
When I remember. Now, I don't know if that rings a bell for anybody.
It does ring a bell, but I've not planted it.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Field Day is great up at the station. This year it's happening on August 20th. And just a lot of fun. A lot of people show up and different taste testing and tours and information that goes on, usually music and food and just a lot of good people.
Yeah.
So appreciate that community outreach. But mark your calendars. There's a lot going on this year. I mean, just in general, events that are happening. Your garden tour, Lance, is happening in August, right?
August 4th.
Mm-hmm.
Right, with Boga.
Yeah, that's with Boga, and that's actually for fall planting. And it will be a garden tour, but it's really fall planting a crop for fall harvest.
Cool.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to mention another Voga Learning Council workshop that's coming up here in Paonia at the Hearth. It's happening Monday, April 7th, which isn't too far away, at 5:30 here. And it's Colorado Water, What's Happening to Colorado Irrigated Agriculture. And that's with Robert Cicada. And that should be super interesting. Water is always a super interesting topic. Brad, with all these experiments that you have going on, how do you account for the changes in temperature, longer, shorter seasons, different freeze times that are occurring just naturally with climate changes?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. You know, we're just trying to roll with it, roll with the changes, you know, this year. We might not have water for the whole year because of the snowpack.
Yeah.
and we do our best and we monitor the health of the trees and the different varieties. And we hope any information we glean could help growers in the future from just the stress that our land is put under, same as these other producers in the area. But also, we're getting more into technology for remote sensing of the environment. And so one thing on the squash bug trial is we're going to be doing soil moisture sensing at 5 inches below and then 24 inches below the soil to keep track of when we're irrigating, how far is it penetrating, how long is the soil moisture staying at where we need it to be. And I mean, the reason why I was doing that at first was because we're going to do these different methods, the roller crimp, right? And then we're going to do bare soil and then a plastic mulch, like a, yeah, just black plastic, weed fabric kind of thing. And all those different treatments, soil's going to dry out faster or slower in those different treatments, right? So if we want these all treated the same, we better make sure that we're watering them the same. So that's why we're using the soil moisture sensors to keep track of how much water has to get put in the bare soil versus the plastic weed fabric. And so in doing that, we're kind of indirectly looking at water conservation methods and setting us up to start measuring that kind of stuff in the future.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
It continues.
It does. Yeah, it's just going to keep evolving.
Yeah. And there's a lot of cool gadgets out there to do that just in your backyard garden, aren't there? Like temperature things and...
Oh, right. Yeah. There's some cheap versions and, yeah, we have like data loggers and things like that. But, I mean, they're not that expensive. And even CSU is starting to develop 3D printed ones.
Oh,
so like the
that's the whole concept is, that like
and it's like a little modular thing and then they 3D print the temperature sensor and and then and they're selling them for really cheap for growers to use or anyone to use around the state and so it's like maybe 30, 40 bucks to get yourself a a little weather station.
Yeah, cool. So climate really is always just the X factor for farmers and for you as well, conducting these experiments. I mean, it's the the unknown. It's
It is. Yeah. I mean, I don't think we should all switch to indoor agriculture just yet.
Okay.
No.
Good.
Not for me. not for me. No. But I know that the frost-free days for the growing season is actually extended 2 weeks on both ends.
Really?
Yeah.
Here in the valley?
In the western Colorado. It's
like, wow.
It's pretty amazing.
So that's 4 extra weeks, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Of growing season?
Yeah. Of frost-free growing season.
Wow.
Because, like, I'm going to plant next weekend, but they'll be frozen, but they'll be able to live through it, spinach and lettuce and stuff.
Yeah, there's, sure.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we can start direct seeding chili then, right?
There you go.
you could direct seed tomatoes. Yeah. Chilies is... They're really too slow. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Brad is a chili aficionado for sure.
A little bit.
Yeah. And you, when did that come on for you? When you were in New Mexico or?
Yes, of course. You know, it's part of the culture down there.
Right.
And I got nothing against Pueblo chili either. They got different tastes. But yeah, before coming here, I worked at New Mexico State University down in Las Cruces and helping out with the chili pepper breeding program. And so there was a lot of chili culture down there and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. It seems like it's getting even more popular, the varieties.
Oh yeah.
Up at Thistle Whistle, Mark grows so many different varieties of chilies. Super fun.
Yeah.
And a story behind every one of them, I think.
Yeah, he knows them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's Mark that says that a hot chili that'll set you straight.
Yeah.
You know? You ever need to be slapped back into reality, just pop a hot chili in your mouth. What is it with the heat factor and chilies? How do you turn it up or how do you measure that?
Well, you measure it by... Scoville heat units.
Okay.
So you've heard of those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes from, what is it? Like a roasting chili, which I'm more familiar with, just those meaty ones. You know, they're hanging out around 1,000 or so levels of heat units, and then a hotter chili will be more like 40,000 or 30,000. Whoa,
really?
Yeah, and it's a funny measurement system, you know. How you do it, it was invented by this researcher named Scoville, and he essentially, it's really simple, but what you do is you'll grind up your chili, so maybe dry it, grind it up, put it in some water, and then you'll have someone taste it, and if they feel heat, then you dilute it 1-to-1 or 10-to-1. Mm-hmm. Then you taste it again. And if you still feel the heat, then you dilute it again. And so the Scoville heat unit is how long does it take for someone to not taste heat anymore? After like dilution after dilution after dilution. Uh-huh. That's it. Like that's so the really high number means yes, it had to get diluted a lot before anything was tasted.
Wow. Yeah.
So those ghost peppers and or habaneros are way up on the scale.
Right. I think they were like getting to 1 million or something.
No,
I don't know.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. Quote me on that, but it's getting crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, don't have to worry about me.
No, me neither.
Medium's just fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And is Hatch chili, is that just a particular brand of chili or?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. So Hatch chili is originally, it was named after the place. So there's a town called Hatch in southern New Mexico. And it's an agricultural town and they grow a lot of chili there. And anything that was called Hatch chili was coming out of that small valley. And what's happened recently is that it's getting more popular. Hatch is in the name of a lot of things. It's mm-hmm. branding. It's
yeah.
in. Oh. And so oftentimes if the truck drives through Hatch, they call it Hatch chili. It's kind of the joke. And so it's coming from Mexico, coming from further south and either Texas or New Mexico, you know, they just call it Hatch. And what's even funnier is I'm noticing that some people who grow up here, they've like called a variety Hatch chili. And I don't know if there is a variety of pepper called Hatch.
Yeah.
It's, it's just from where it's grown, because all the people that grow and down in Hatch, the varieties they use are like Joe Parker and Big Jim and what you'd call a quote-unquote Anaheim chili.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the Anaheim chili is the New Mexico chili. It was developed by Fabian Garcia, who was at New Mexico State University, early 1900s. And
wow.
He developed this chili because he was like the first breeder that had a job there. And what happened, though, is that growers in Southern California liked the seed and they started growing it, and the agriculture there was a lot larger and more influential.
Mm-hmm.
So as chili grown from Fabian Garcia's seed was getting distributed across the country from Anaheim region, it started being called the Anaheim.
Anaheim.
Pepper. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, that's a whole lot of history there. But yeah, Hatch chili from the town of Hatch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Soil, water, sunlight mix.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
From Hatch.
Yeah. And what are the optimal conditions for growing chilies?
Well, really long season.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A solid, you know, 180 day plus frost-free situation. You know, a lot of the growers down there do direct seed. And that's a... It's a really, it's a cool way to do it because they overseed like a lot, kind of like you'd seed carrots, you know,
yeah.
And then you thin them. You actually go through and thin your chili plants to be 6 inches apart. And they're usually little clumps of chili plants, like 3 or 4 in a group.
Wow.
And then they come up and they produce and then they'll pick and then they'll let it grow a little more. So they usually get 2 picks through the year.
Wow, okay.
I think I sidetracked myself, though. What was your question?
Growing conditions, optimal growing.
Oh, growing conditions, yeah. Right. So you grow them like that. You need a long season.
Yeah.
But really, the hot days help it out a lot. You know, the chili does kind of stop growing once it's 95.
Mm-hmm.
It shuts down, but those hot days really help it to put flavor, put heat into it, mm-hmm. and so the cold days don't necessarily give it a lot of flavors.
Yeah. So, but are they insect pollinated, or are they stimulation by wind and movement?
Mostly insect.
Okay.
Uh huh.
Okay.
Yeah. But they also, those chili plants like to self pretty well.
Okay.
So they'll either self kind of like a tomato would, but
mm-hmm.
Insect pollination happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Brad, thank you so much for sharing everything that's going on up there at the Research Center right here in the North Fork on Rogers Mesa. And I just really think it's awesome that to hear how the science works, and that science really does give us a lot of great information and is helping this mm-hmm. community, farmers, gardeners, orchardists, to improve their crops and the outcome. And we appreciate what you do up there and all the events that you have. And again, your Instagram tag is?
@ CSU Rogers Mesa.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So you can check it out there. Cool. And peach care and pruning's coming up, and you can, I guess, grab the calendar at your Instagram site as well.
Yes, you can.
Mm-hmm. Stuff going on all summer long and into the fall even. So thanks so much for being here tonight. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Well, that was great.
Thanks, Jill. Thanks, Lance.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week, and our friend and fellow worm Amber Kleinman will be joining us. Shout out to our partner Lulu over in the Roaring Fork. She's over there with Big Hal and Amy. Hello. And thanks, everybody, for listening to As the Worm Turns on KVNF.
All right. Have a good evening.